You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, August 2, 2009, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
In 1993, I had the opportunity to go on an MCC learning tour in the Middle East, and one of the countries we visited was Syria. It's pretty hard to get into Syria and visit there. After I came back, I wrote up some of my experiences, and I would like to read one of my experiences here. We spent a few hours in the village of Ma'alula, a village which still speaks Aramaic, the language of Jesus. There is a shrine there, actually a cave high on the mountain, for the first Syrian Christian woman martyr. Here is her story, as told to us by the Mother Superior of the convent there, which has 9 nuns and 15 orphanage girls. Saint Tekla was born in Iconium, now in Turkey, into a prominent governing family. Her father died, and she made her home with the Sultan, a pagan, as everyone was at the time. Saint Paul came to the city, and Tekla heard him preach from her window. She became a Christian, and then gathered the girls of the city to teach them the new faith. The Sultan did not approve of her new faith and tried to get her to leave it. He threw her to the beasts, but she experienced a miracle. The beasts remained calm, and she was not eaten. Then he wanted to burn her in the square. People came to see what would happen. Tekla cried out in a high voice, "Please accept my spirit." But at that moment, darkness came and rain came down and put out the fire. Again, she was rescued. Next, the Sultan wanted to cut off her head. This time, she had to escape. She heard that St. Paul was in Damascus, so she headed off to Damascus via Antioch. On the way, she saw peasants planting seeds. She blessed the planting and told the seeds to bring good fruit. She prayed there, and the peasants were astonished with her presence. Tekla fled on her way. The seeds grew and became fruit in a very short time and were ready for harvest. At that point, the Sultan, who was still following her, came to the peasants and asked about her. "When did she pass this land?" The peasants answered, "When we were planting this seed." So the Sultan, thinking she had been there many months ago, turned with his group and went looking in another direction for her. In the meantime, Tekla came to a large mountain and did not know how she could have the energy to cross it with pursuers likely not far behind. She prayed, "God, who rescued me from the animals, fire, and kings, please help me and give me the power to cross this mountain." She thought it would be a physical power that she would receive. But a gap appeared in the mountain, providing a narrow crevice through which she could easily pass. And incidentally, our group hiked through this passage. Then springs also appeared. She reached the mountainous village of Ma'alula and stayed in one of the many caves there. People came to her because of her healing powers. She used water from the spring to wash the patients. She is now buried in that cave that serves as her shrine. Now, some of the things that the nun told us are also in a New Testament apocryphal book called the Acts of Paul, and part of that book is called the Acts of Paul and Tekla. But some of the things in that book are not in the nun's story. They don't all quite line up one-to-one. And one of the things that's in the Acts of Paul and Tekla that the nun didn't mention is that Tekla was, it was arranged for her to marry a certain man, and she refused. And her refusal was part of her Christian conversion as well. And so her initial punishment was probably both for refusing to marry this man and her Christianity and teaching others about it. Saint Tekla and her virgin martyrdom, although she's never actually killed, is much venerated in Syria and other areas around there. And that's an area of continuous Christianity. Basically, the missionaries there were Saint Paul and his contemporaries. Is the story of Tekla true? Well, we could debate that, but what we can all agree on is that her story is interesting, intriguing, and inspiring. And I don't see some of our nerds here today, but Tekla in Spanish is spelled T-E-K-L-A, and that's the same word as key for keyboard in computers. And so Tekla, Saint Tekla, is considered in Spain as the patron saint of computers, in case you ever need one of those. I'm bringing the story of Tekla here today for two reasons. One is this book of Timothy, we're going through it. It can be a bit boring because there are no stories in it, so I thought we needed a story. We needed to lighten up. But a more serious reason is that I think her story might lend some light on the verses in Timothy. And as Andre mentioned, I'm going to limit my talk to verses 3 through 16, and that's on aid to widows. And I've been intrigued by those verses for quite a while, wondering what they were all about, but I never really studied them. So you'll have to just cover the rest of the verses at home. On superficial examination, these verses seem to be very critical of widows. And the goal seems to be to limit the financial aid to them. And widows younger than 60 are especially discriminated against. And limits were put on those over 60s as well, depending on if they had lived a good, proper life beforehand or if they had relatives that could look after them. There are accusations of heresy, that the younger women are gossips and saying things that they shouldn't say. There's an implication that some of these younger widows took vows of celibacy and then couldn't or didn't follow through on them, that they're sexually irresponsible. And the younger widows are told to marry, unlike some teachings of Paul in Corinthians that support remaining single. And there's a contradiction. If the younger women remarry, then and they become a widow again, which they're most likely to do, then they wouldn't get aid after they're 60. But it's unclear whether being wife of one husband is one husband or one husband at a time. So this critical approach to aid for widows is puzzling in light of all the things that we've heard read, and in light of Jewish practices of the time. In the Old Testament, caring for widows was a key justice issue. In the New Testament time, the Jews usually gave out aid weekly at the synagogues. And if you remember the encounter Jesus had with the widow who gave her mite, it gives that story even more poignancy, because where did she get her money and how much money was it? And here she was, instead of just receiving, she was also giving. When Jesus was on the verge of death, it's not his last words, but some of his last words, they were to his beloved disciples saying, "Here is your mother." So he's looking after his mother, who is probably a widow, making sure that she would be taken care of. That story about Tabitha or Dorcas sewing the clothes for the widows, reading between the lines there, these widows were not just lamenting that they weren't going to get any more free clothing, but I think there was a relationship with Dorcas as well there, not just the clothes that she sewed for them. So in light of all these positive things said about helping widows, I'd like to pose two questions. In this passage, why did the writer want to limit financial aid for the widows? And the second question, why did the writer put limits on widows or women? So the first question, why did the writer want to cut back on financial aid for the widows? Well, if you heard the news this week, I think it's the same story. The province is cutting back on support for repairing leaky condos. Well, there's still the need, but they're saying that there isn't enough money. And I think it was a similar situation there. There certainly was a need in the early church, but they had limited financial resources. There were Christians who were rich, and we know that for several reasons, but in chapter 6, which is next Sunday's chapter, there is advice for the rich. So we know there were rich people. And incidentally, Donna Stewart is going to speak on this, and you should come and hear her, because she's had a long life, and I don't think she's going to mind my saying that, a long life of working at justice issues for the poor. But along with these rich people that are being given some advice, we know there were lots of poor people too, because there were slaves and people like that. So the church probably had limited financial resources, no doubt about that. And on the other side, there were many women attracted to Christianity. And possibly some of their groups looked like, not so much like our group here, but like some of the more mainline Christian congregations, where there were all, you know, 70%, 80% women, whatever. Galatians 3:28 is that equality verse that we remember, no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female. So that was very attractive to women. And then there were some prominent women. One example is Nympha, and she's in Colossians, mentioned there. She had a household that hosted a Christian community, and she probably hosted some traveling teachers as well. And when there are prominent women like that, then that in the movement, then that would attract other women. Now, when they mention widows in this passage, I don't think they're always meaning widows the way we think of widows. Some of the widows could be women who converted to Christianity and their husbands didn't, and their husbands divorced them. So the women could have been out on their own. And everybody got married in those days. But there still could be some women who, because of a physical or mental deformity, never got married. So they would be like widows. Someone has figured out from some data from Egypt, I think, so I don't know how good it is, that only 4 out of 100 women live beyond the age of 50. So basically, the room here would be almost empty if that was the case today. So the number of widows over 60 would have been few in number. So when they're really restricting it, you've got to be over 60. I don't know, that would be like our 90 maybe. And that would be very few in number. But some women did live to older age. And we know of Anna in the book of Luke, who lived in the temple and spent her time praying and fasting, and she was all of 84. Family groups of the time could include a number of widows. There could be the mother, the daughter-in-law, the granddaughter, cousin, aunt, niece, and so on. And it was the law in society that the extended family household would take care of the widows. The widows carried a dowry with them, and if they went back to their family of origin, then their family of origin was supposed to look after them. If they stayed with their husband's family, then they were supposed to look after them. Now, in the verses, it sort of implies that there's some abuse of the church's aid, that some families that could take care of their own widows weren't doing that. And you can see why that might happen. And, you know, the way people are these days, and those days too, there could be people who decided, hey, if we join this movement, the church will take care of our widows. So there could have been abuse. In conclusion, the reduction, the cutback in aid for the widows, the limitations, were likely due to inadequate financial resources of these beginning Christian communities compared to the number of widows needing aid. So the next question, why did the writer put limits on women in this passage? Although I doubt that Paul wrote the books of Timothy, they are attributed to him in the first verse of the book. So the writer, whoever it was trying to bring good repute to Christians of the time. So he ended up modifying or providing a one-sided view of some of Paul's teachings in other writings. Secular society consisted of patriarchal households. So in order to be accepted and well thought of, there was pressure for the Christian community to be the same. Hence the instruction for the young widows to marry again. Get them back into the patriarchal system, and incidentally, financially taken care of. It's a pragmatic approach. Widows over 60 could be given aid if they had done all the correct patriarchal things. I think it was assumed widows over 60 weren't going to marry again. So voluntary celibacy is not very popular today, and it's one reason why we Mennonites own this former convent. However, in the time of Paul and Timothy, taking a vow of celibacy as a virgin or as a widow could have been regarded less as a life of renunciation than as a life of freedom. Childbirth was very dangerous, so it would be a way to avoid childbirth. It would be a way to avoid being tied down to however many kids you have, and a lot of them dying. It would be a way to avoid a not very good husband or an abusive husband. It would be a way to avoid being part of a repressive household where the father-in-law or grandfather-in-law was in charge. Basically, there was very little freedom for women. In Tekla's story, we see that celibacy and getting involved in spreading Christianity was so attractive to her that she embraced martyrdom numerous times. But unmarried Christian women would have been looked on with great suspicion by secular society. So this is another reason for the writer of Timothy to teach that the young widows should marry. And the widows remaining single over the age 60 would be tolerated if it showed how they, if it could be shown how they fit into the patriarchal system in their past. The early church was radical in considering everyone on equal terms, whether slave or master, male or female. And I think we can safely assume that unmarried people would have been accepted. Paul's teaching in 1 Corinthians 7 certainly supports single people. In view of the impending crisis, it is well for you to remain as you are. Basically, he said, if you're married, stay married. If you're not married, don't marry. For unmarried people, this could be seen as a special calling based on the end of the world coming soon. In the apocryphal book that I mentioned before, the Acts of Paul, his teachings are even more pointed and radical, basically throwing out marriage completely. It is possible that these latter teachings against marriage, which have not found their way into our Bible, were circulating and being discussed, particularly by women, who saw in them a way out of the dominant submissive relations in their family. And this teaching against marriage could have been one of the heresies that the writer of Timothy feared. The writer's thrust in Timothy is to get a good reputation for the Christian community, both within the community itself and in society in general, by giving instructions to various categories of people. There were instructions about character to church leaders, who likely had groups meeting in their house, slaves, young widows, old widows, the rich, as well as advice to Timothy on how to relate to older and younger men and older and younger women. Everyone had his or her order and place. I think of the book of Timothy as Paul calmed down. Its presence in the canon dilutes some of Paul's more radical words in his other books. With the book of Timothy, the early radicalness of Christianity has its rough edges smoothed over, maybe even eroded, by teaching that is pragmatic and makes sense. Everyone ends up with a good and honorable character. Families are looking after their own, and all is acceptable to both Christian and contemporary society. As verse 14 says, so as to give the adversary no occasion to revile us. That's a little bit different than the NIV, but similar meaning. But when everything is carefully laid out, there's often an underground of discontent. There are some people who want to check back with the basics. We have an example from our own Anabaptist history. The early Anabaptists questioned the entrenched practices of the Catholic Church and the beliefs of the early Protestant movements, and they looked back to the early church as a model. Perhaps some Christians in Ephesus remembered early apostolic teachings that were more radical. They may have heard about the primitive church in Jerusalem going from house to house breaking bread. They may have questioned whether the meaning of Jesus' teaching, life, death, and resurrection was about fitting in with the system. Stories often relay truths more clearly than instructions or complex theology. And now back to the story of Tekla. Is it possible that her story was circulating in Ephesus, particularly among women, who admired her freedom and her guts? And this is why they were, quoting verse 13, saying what they should not say.